This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with economists Rick Wolf and Max Wolf about the current economic crisis.
They'll tell us whether Obama's stimulus package will keep the wolf away from our door.
In the 1990s, over 500 women inmates in Michigan were sexually assaulted by prison guards.
After 18 years, some of those cases have gone to trial. Resounding victories for the women, and hopefully for the end of sexual abuse and rape in Michigan's prisons.
Stay with us.
As listeners know, we have oftentimes covered one of our most wonderful guests, Lori Arbeiter. Lori is responsible for the T-shirts that say, "We will not be silent," in English and in Arabic, as well as the Arrest Bush T-shirts, Arrest Cheney, all of that.
Arrest Cheney first.
And Lori, as you know, was also out at the Republican National Convention in Minneapolis, got stopped herself for this T-shirt stuff, and is a really courageous woman who was out there with these T-shirts. And a lot of people have gotten these T-shirts. And she told us the story at one point of somebody who was taken off an airplane, a JetBlue plane, for wearing one of these "We Will Not Be Silent" T-shirts. Now, we have an update on that story. Michael?
The fella is an Arab gentleman named Raed Jarrar. And he was told by the JetBlue personnel that he had to take his T-shirt off. He wouldn't do it. So the next suggestion that the airline personnel made was that he had to wear a T-shirt over his "We Will Not Be Silent" T-shirt. And the T-shirt that they got him in the airport gift store was a "I Love America" T-shirt. They put that on the guy and let him fly. He landed, found the ACLU, started a lawsuit, and a couple of weeks ago, victory was announced. He hit JetBlue for $280,000. What do you think of that, Michael?
I think I want to wear an "I Love America" T-shirt. That's what I think. I can be bought. I'm really amazed. I mean, I want him to test it again. I want him to go on the airline again with a "We Will Not Be Silent" T-shirt on JetBlue or another airline and see what happens.
It's a huge amount of money. I have people with broken legs that I sue for that don't get that much. It's a huge amount of money. It's a real statement where our values should be. And incidentally, Michael, the T-shirt also had "We Will Not Be Silent" in Hebrew.
Again, as listeners know, the Center for Constitutional Rights and some other organizations have what's called the 100 Days Campaign, trying to have the Obama administration reverse in the first 100 days some of the nastier depredations that the Bush administration was involved with. Last week, we talked about the closing of Guantanamo in a year. There will be more updates on that as we go along to see how it's really meant, whether we'll really close it. I think we will, but whether people will be subject to a preventive detention scheme of some sort, which we would be very opposed to. We've had a stopping or an application of the Army Field Manual to all agencies of the United States government. The Army Field Manual interrogation techniques now are the only techniques that can be used by the CIA as well as others against detainees in U.S. custody. There's been some criticism of the Army Field Manual techniques. There's an Annex M that allows long-term isolation that many civil libertarians object to is still being too lenient in allowing cruel treatment or conceivably torture. But that's the second important issue. The third one, of course, was the closing of the secret sites and some others. But recently this week, we saw a lifting of what's called the gag rule that the Bush administration had said that you can't give any money to foreign nations, foreign organizations, for anything to do with abortion or abortion counseling. That was reversed in an executive order. Again, very good. There was also, is in the process of happening, the idea that states can set their own emission rules for automobiles in their states, which is to say that normally the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, sets the national rules and states cannot get more stringent about emissions from automobiles. The automobile industry has opposed the states being able to set their own emissions rule. But despite that, the Obama administration seems to be going ahead with that as well. We also had, which is really interesting to me, the Supreme Court last year, the year before, 5-4 ruled in a discrimination suit brought on behalf of a woman that she could not collect back wages more than 180 days back because she had failed to bring the suit in time. It was contrary to what we had understood the law to be on discrimination. Congress just passed a law, which will soon be signed, that reverses that Supreme Court decision. It's an important one for pay equity cases. So we're getting a number of things, if not right, at least some of the promises are being confirmed.
In the wake of historic massive bailouts to banks, the Democratic Party has proposed an economic stimulus plan designed to create 3 million jobs, provide tax cuts, and stimulate areas of the economy such as energy and health care. We're joined today by returning guests Max and Rick Wolf to give us an analysis of the stimulus package. Rick Wolf is a professor of economics, now retired from the University of Massachusetts, who teaches at the Brecht Forum and the New School in New York City. Max Frodwolf is a freelance researcher, strategist, and writer in the areas of international finance and macroeconomics. Max's work can be seen at the Huffington Post, the Asian Times, Prudent Bear, and Seeking Alpha. Max, Rick, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, the first question I think on all our minds, will go to you first, Max, and then you, Rick, is the stimulus package. I read the headlines of the New York Times, and it's talking about, you know, stuff that I actually care about, like more health insurance or something, more school aid for people, a number of other social issues that at least look more Keynesian to me than before, dropping down. So that sounded okay to me. Is that good? Is it going to get us out of this thing? Is he doing enough? What do you think of the stimulus package?
So I think the world is full of born-again Keynesians, many of whom were neoliberals last year, but they kept their job and they kept their influence. And the $64,000 question is, do they keep their worldview and do they keep their policy packages? I would tend to agree with you that when you look at this stimulus, it's a kinder, gentler, more competent, and much larger version of the kind of things we began to see about 12 months ago when the Bush administration realized that the gig was up, things were bad, and money had to be sloshed around to placate people and prevent worse outcomes. So I think there are a lot of very interesting and good ideas bundled in there, and it's nice to see some money to modernize an electrical grid, which in this country is now not the envy of even the developing world, which is a problem. It's nice to see a little bit of money for sustainable development of various types, for public transit, and for a bunch of education, health, and welfare programs. But we're seeing a kindler, gentler, and much more competent same old, but bigger. And so I don't think we're going to see a sea change in the way the country works, at least not caused by this. Definitely not caused by the stimulus package, maybe by the recession. So I don't think it's a massive change. I don't think the whole way we do business is shifting or the foundation of the economy is shifting, but it's going to be a kinder, gentler, more competent version of what we've suffered through in the past.
Rick?
Well, to complement what Max said, I would say the following. One of the hallmarks of the failure of the Bush administration's efforts to deal with this problem was its programs of giving huge amounts of money to banks, which neatly avoided facing the problem that it was in large part the decisions and behaviors of the banks that got us into the problem. And since no change was made in who runs these banks and the logic under which these banks run, giving a lot of money to the people who already screwed the economy up is not the best recipe for fixing it. Now we have the Obama administration, which, if you look closely at the stimulus, comes up with the following. A great deal of money is going to be given back to people and businesses in the form of tax rebates and tax cuts, and a great deal is going to be given to the states. The people who will get the tax rebates, as we already know from the previous tax cuts, are likely to use it in ways that do not boost the economy. Because business is bad, businesses saving their tax money are not going to run around and spend it. Because people are frightened, they're going to take their tax cuts and bank them, which is what they did already last year. And finally, the states, all 50 of them, are notorious in having refuse to see the handwriting on the wall, refuse to take steps of all sorts to cope with the emerging crisis, and we're going to give them a lot more money to do the kind of political haggling and pork barrel arrangements that they did in the past and that they usually do, with the result that what you're left with is that a relatively small amount of the stimulus is actually going to go into immediate, clear promotional efforts that might actually improve the economy. When you look at it that way, the amount of money, again, that is finally going to be used in a productive way is very small, and the amount of opportunity for this to be dissipated as a fiscal policy that didn't work to match the monetary policy that didn't work under Bush, that would be my guess of where we're headed. That we will all be sitting here 3-6 months from now saying, my goodness, this didn't work either.
Max, do you agree with Rick?
There's an overwhelming probability that the high hopes for the stimulus, much like the high hopes for President Obama himself, are based more on people's desperate desire to see things improve and wishes and hopes than they are on any kind of concrete, verifiable economic analysis. I do think that this will make things better than if we didn't have a stimulus. I would certainly agree with that. I think we need a stimulus, but I think we need structural change, and it's a missed opportunity. If we're going to go through this much pain, if we're going to go this much deeper into debt, and everyone likes to blow that question off, and it's high time we stopped. But, I mean, that aside, if we're going to go this much more into debt and we're going to endure this much pain, why not seize this opportunity to restructure the economy a bit so that we don't just sort of throw more money after the money we wasted in the last 10 or 20 years? So I don't think structural change is imminent, but I do think this will make the situation substantively better than it would have been otherwise. And I think it'll be substantively disappointing against expectations that are celestial at this point.
One notion that many of us share about restructuring the economy is that instead of just throwing money at the banks, those banks be nationalized, they be democratized, that there be transparency, that there be control over what they do. Can you elaborate on that, please?
Sure. I mean, one of the major problems we have, which no one wants to admit, is we did both the bad policies you could do monetary policy-wise. We did two things. We kind of nationalized the banks without nationalizing them, and we kind of bailed out the private banks without giving them enough money. So we gave a lot of money, $300, $400 billion direct and maybe another trillion in guarantees indirectly to the banks to keep them from going bankrupt. We gave them enough money so that they wouldn't have to go bankrupt immediately, but not enough money to get back in the business of banking, which is a pretty big problem. And then we turned the Federal Reserve, with no public debate, no public discussion, and no congressional intervention, into a giant national central bank at the same time, which no one mentions. And the Federal Reserve is getting into the business of buying U.S. treasuries, loaning money to corporations, bailing out private banks. And so we did sort of both. We decided to bail out the private banks, but not enough to get them back in the banking business, and partially nationalize the operations formerly done by banks, but not quite enough to fill the gap. So I think the policy that we've had is largely a little bit of everything, which is the most expensive and least cogent, coherent way to go. And so I think that was a major disaster. And I think going forward, we do have a problem, which is even our concentration on the banks is excessive. To me, the lesson we should have learned from the last 25 years is that you cannot use credit and debt to substitute for people who don't earn enough money to live and people who don't save enough money to buy anything that's more expensive than 2 weeks or 2 months of wages. And so long as that's true, and it remains true, we will be a weak, vulnerable economy slipping deeper into a debt trap.
I would, again, hammer at one point. The fundamental for me phenomena that produced the last 30 years of crazy economic misdevelopment has been the end of rising real wages. The mass of American workers stopped having the rising wages that they had become used to for over 100 years. And in the 1970s, that all came to an end. It came to an end because corporations found ways to stop paying higher wages. They never did it out of the goodness of their heart. They did it because the system required it. After the 1970s, it didn't. Between outsourcing to cheap place workers in other parts of the world, between the computer that substituted machines for people, between the desperate women who came out of households to sustain their family's income looking for jobs, the desperate immigrants from the third world that came here, you put all that mixed together, they didn't have to pay any more wages. To a population who believes that their success in life is a rising standard of living. Well, if people believe that, and if are taught by every advertisement, by every politician, and by every cultural guru to think that the measure of your own personal success is rising standard of living, but you don't give them the wages to pay for it, then they're going to borrow. With banks eager to lend, you produced an explosion of credit that could not in the end be sustained. Our problem is now you fund the banks again, you tell them to go lend, they can't. They can't lend because people can't handle more debt. It's an impossible situation, and it applies increasingly to corporations as well that are overborrowed, and now to governments that are borrowing. One thing to stress also here that no one wants to discuss, the entire stimulus that Obama is pushing, as well as the second stimulus that people are already talking about later this year, is premised on the notion that the United States government can continue to borrow at limitless rates, monies larger in toto than we have ever as a nation borrowed before, when the rest of the world is having an increasingly difficult time making ends meet, let alone lending to the United States. The disorganization of the world economy, a screwy development in which what is going to help this world is an America that is going to have to suck all of the excess money out of the rest of the world, bring it here to kind of get this machine going. That's going to produce the most bizarre disorganization of the world economy that's simply creating another crisis not that far down the road.
But I remember we had you here right before the vote on the bank stimulus package, which is what we'd call it. And I don't remember your answer as well, Max. I remember Rick's really well. Both of you thought it was a necessary thing to do. Rick said, you think it's necessary to do, may not be the best necessary to do, because, of course, you were worried about, coming from your background, the rise of a right-wing working class that could be a precursor to fascism. But apart from that explanation of why, do you both feel that way today, that it was still the right thing to give a stimulus package like that?
We had reached a crisis. The ruling ideology of Bush, but not just Bush, of also the Democratic Party and also the business establishment, was the ruling ideology of 30 years in which private enterprise and markets are a one-way ticket to the magic world of prosperity and growth. When it became clear to many of us that something was terribly wrong, this ideology, dominant as it was, made the government, made the business community look the other way, tell each other stories. Remember Mr. Greenspan telling us we were in a new economy that simply went up and that we all had to relax and get over our anxieties and things were really wonderful. Well, that led them to wait much too long. So by the time it became an issue to bail out the banks, the statistics that we were all looking at, those of us who pay attention, were so dire, were so extreme, because you had waited so long that, of course, we endorsed it because something had to be done. And this was the only thing at that time that was politically feasible, that was on the table, and that was taken seriously. But we all had reservations that a program of giving money to the very banks that had been central to the entire problems building up was a very dubious proposition.
Yeah, I still think that the TARP was absolutely necessary. Necessary, but not sufficient. I don't think that you should have given it as a pet project, particularly to the Paulson office and Mr. Kashkari. And I don't think their approach or their 12 different herky-jerky approaches announced with no discussion on surprise meetings on Sunday afternoons was the way to go. But I would be surprised if this stimulus package works any much better than the TARP. The reason that the people who loved the stimulus package hated the TARP is pure, unadulterated ideology. Some people believe private markets are magical and they solve capitalism's problems and indeed humanity's problems. And some people believe that the government, the same government they were skeptical of until November 3rd, is actually going to magically solve their problems. They're both wrong, and that's what creates the big dividing line between the TARP was evil, the stimulus is great, or the TARP was great and the stimulus is evil, whether you're talking about Democrats, Republicans, more liberal or more conservative. We needed to do something to bail out the banks, which could have been nationalization, and we discussed that. That's a way to take care of the problem. But clearly the political will was not behind that in this country then. It's not so clear that it is now, but it certainly is clear that it wasn't then. So I think we needed something. I don't think we got it. But I also think people are scapegoating the banks. The bottom line is we're asking the banks to give more money to people right now when we have an international economic crisis because they loan too much to people who can't pay them back. That is prima facie absurd. We want to get out of the economy by getting banks to keep loaning to people who couldn't afford the loans they've been getting since 2003 and have now tanked the global economy because they can't pay back the loans they already have while they get fired in droves and their wages get cut and their bonuses vanish. So their ability to repay is declining, and their debt is high, and it's not a tenable solution, in my opinion.
One little point, which isn't so little. Monetary policy is usually the first, most conservative way to try to deal with an economic crisis. That's been true before. If and when it doesn't work, you move to something that's a little more government intrusive. Keynes, Obama, intervention, stimulus, fiscal, all that. Both of these efforts have as the unspoken backdrop, the partner, the goal to somehow pull the economy out of a disaster without making much more fundamental structural changes. First, it's the hope that the banks will do it with the Federal Reserve. Now it's the hopes that the government will intervene with spending. Notice these two things. They both don't change the basic organization of our society. They don't change the basic economy. It's basically throwing one kind of money or then another kind of money, hoping that everybody who's in power, the people who run the businesses, the people who run the government, can together, by trial and error, come up with what'll bail us out. The hidden hope that no one speaks about is that it'll get solved before we have to face the much more fundamental question that I think Max is pointing to, is that the basic way we organize production, we decide who gets wages, who gets profits, how big they are, how we're going to produce the goods that we can afford as a nation to consume, those questions of reorganization and basic are those the questions that we want not to have to ask because we're afraid of what the answers might be.
Well, I'm not afraid of the answer, and I'm going to ask the question. If the four of us sitting around these microphones had our druthers, we wouldn't let the economy be run by a small group of people who own and control. What sort of notions do you have, Rick and Max, about how we could have a genuinely democratically run economy?
I want to add to that question. I think there's two. One is how you would do it if you had basically could do what you wanted, which is sort of where Michael's question's going. And the second one would be the more reformist model. Is there anything Obama can do within the confines of our American structure that would actually help?
Yeah, there are a lot of things he can do, some of which he will do, some of which he's discussing already, in fairness. So, I mean, in fair to him. And let's be fair to Obama, too. We don't need to buy into the social discussion, which is crazy, that Obama is actually an economist or knows what the hell is going on. Five advisors tell him his position on each of the 20 things, and he listens, if you're lucky, in a smart way, and figures out which of the five experts he's beholden to he feels like listening to this month until that doesn't work, and then next, and down the line. So it's not really his fault, right? People fetishize this sort of magical God King president, whether they love or hate the person. And that's a little bit unfair to the person. It's certainly unfair to President Obama. But I do think there are a lot of things that could be done to make things better. I think you kind of got to take the big question seriously, and no one is. I would certainly agree with Rick on that one. And my bottom line, it's pretty easy. We need to have higher wages, which means lower profits, and that's just the way the cookie crumbles. We need to pay people more. We need national health care immediately just to sort of get through the crisis, which is obvious. We need to import a little less. We need to export a little more. We need to save a bunch less, and we need to spend a bunch less. And that means 10 years of economic pain, best case scenario, while you recenter the economy and teach people a different way to view their citizenship and their success and their livelihood and their aspirations. And that would be the more reformist social democratic path. I think that there's a lot of reluctance to take that path, even in countries with more advanced political critique than we have generally here. And usually that is used as a desperate rescue when the folks in charge are terrified of masses of angry people demanding more than that. And so it becomes a tenable compromise. Well, so is it possible? Yes. Does it look imminent here? No.
Is there something better, you think, than this social democratic path, Rick?
Let me expand first before answering quite what could be done practically. I think the clue there is to look at the last time, right? The Great Depression, FDR, the New Deal. This president came into office with a very serious crisis on the scale of what we have now, maybe worse. ran as a president on a balanced budget program and was then very quickly taken to much more than he ever dreamed he would do. And that same history may unfold for Mr. Obama. He may be saying one thing now and may be forced by developments a year from now or 2 years from now, like Roosevelt was, to do much more. If you look at that history parallel, then the answer to your question could be, for example, if the government is going to be the bank of last resort, the lender of last resort, then obviously the logic will sooner or later arise, why the hell isn't it the employer of last resort? In other words, we have now a rising unemployment, pushing 8%, scheduled to go to 9 or 10, and some people think even higher over the next 12, 18 months. What's the problem here? How come in the entire mix of our stimulus, we don't have a notion that the government, partly to do all the stimulus things and partly to help people that are desperate, through no fault of their own, through a collapse that everyone admits is not their fault, why not give them socially useful jobs at the government's behest?
When you look at Roosevelt, my little bit of knowledge of that, so while he never got us out of the Depression, really, certainly before the war,
he did give
20 million jobs or 25, some huge number. I don't remember.
That's right.
And it at least got people away from desperation.
Right. Well,
that's what I recall.
Also changed the basic function of the U.S. economy. And what everyone talks about Roosevelt doing is wrong. I mean, just patently wrong from the top to the bottom. What got us out of the Great Depression was largely two things, World War II and the total destruction of all our competitors. Everyone's talking the Great Depression and then the happy ending in 46, and everyone skips that 41 to 45 period for the U.S. in which there's a rumor that there was a major conflict and a couple folks lost their lives. I find that a bit suspect. But in order to do something on a par with what Roosevelt did, this stimulus is basically chicken crap comparison, right? You came in with a relatively underdeveloped government, federal government role in the U.S. economy in 1932, 33, 34, and you ballooned the U.S. government to 25% of GDP. In order to do anything on the same scale, what Obama's done so far, and, you know, not really Obama, what the Democrats and the president and the media likes and is supporting right now is, you know, 18% of what FDR was eventually forced to do. And I think across similar basic social pushing, the problem would probably have to rise with much more anger and disturbance in the public. Generally speaking, we haven't seen a systemic, any kind of program or suggestion of systemic change, but we've seen lots of analogies, which is nice, but it's, you know, at best the prelude to the discussion which would produce the policy shift. So we're not too far down the road yet on this. And I don't know if we'll get there or not, but if, you know, to the extent that we learn anything from history, more or less you would need massive pressure from unrest and disturbance, and it would have to be creative and constructive unrest and disturbance. And I think it's not clear that we'll get the unrest and disturbance, although it's starting to look likely, but it's much less clear that it would be creative or organized or progressive and not just sort of angry and criminal.
I want to stress this point. The things that made Roosevelt move, and let's remember structurally, there was no Social Security system in the United States when the Great Depression hit. There was no unemployment insurance in the United States when the Great Depression hit. There was no control of the labor market the way the National Labor Relations Act produced it for the first time in an orderly way to manage these things. There were fundamental changes in the relationship of capital to labor, of government to economy, of government to citizen, on a scale of transformation adequate to the kind of problem, or at least they tried to, and Max is right, it didn't solve it. It was the war and everything about that war that got us out of the Depression. When we took the unemployed we couldn't find work for and put half of them in uniform and the other half making the guns and tanks they had to use in those uniforms. So we have to recognize that fundamental changes of the scale that were necessary then are still not acceptable, publicly discussable by our leaders now. And the fear that Max is articulating delicately, and I want to make real explicit, is what we also had in the 1930s was a powerful upsurge in an organized labor movement, the Congress of Industrial Organizations. We also had strong socialist, communist, and other parties that articulated programs and demands. This enabled a government, which didn't like these movements, nonetheless to be constantly confronted with concrete proposals like unemployment insurance and Social Security and the labor reform and so on. The fear now is we're having people suffer.
We're beginning to see movements of people angry about foreclosure, and we're going to have more of that. But we don't have any organizations comparable to what we had in the 30s, and that changes the politics of our current crisis in very frightening ways. Last thing. In this country, if we wanted to radically alter the way in which our economy got us into this dilemma, in which we have most of the decisions of business made by a tiny group of people called the board of directors, whose first responsibility is to another small group of people, the shareholders. Let's remember that roughly 1% of shareholders own 75% of the shares in America. So the boards of directors are responsible to a very small number of people. If we don't want the kinds of decisions to be made about what's to be produced, what wages are to be paid, where factories are to be located, how business is to be run, to be made by the people who got us into this situation, and we don't want it to be done by government bureaucrats who basically are those same people with a new hat, then we have to change. We have to democratize the control and the organization of American industry in order that we don't repeat this path another time. And that's a conversation that has to be produced by people willing to say that, to discuss it, to debate it. It has its strengths and weaknesses, but it needs to be discussed. Otherwise, we have blinders on as we try to get through this greatest economic crisis in the lifetimes of everyone listening to this program.
Max?
Well, I think the general way that you try to extract more progressive and more focused policy from a new administration is the exact opposite way that progressives and people around the country have responded to the Obama administration. If you want something from someone who has never done anything for you except for be a sort of receptacle for your dreams and imagination, which is a very passive process, then unconditional love is a guarantee of getting banged and dumped, just like it is in your personal life. If you tell someone that you love them no matter what and they're amazing and just being there is enough, you're going to have a real hard time in your relationship. And if that is the progressive community's approach to the new president, they are going to get banged and dumped like everyone else who's run that approach with every other politician. Not because he's a great guy and not because he's a bad guy and not because he's a messiah, no matter how many martyr montages they might have on CNN, but because this is the real world, not the world of your imaginations and past grievances and hopes for the future. And if you don't have a real organization, a real program, a real agenda, and a real voice, then you have to retreat deeper and deeper into your imagination to be happy with the outcome. And at some point in that process, you're nuts and you didn't get what you wanted. So I think that there's a lot to be thankful for in this administration. And I do think that it'll be smarter and more cogent and more competent than the last one. But I always marvel that the people I know who were sure that President Bush was the worst president in the history of the world mostly say they love the new president because he's better than that. But by their own definition, so is everyone else. And that's not going to be quite exciting enough forever. So I think there's an opportunity here, but there's also a risk. And I'm a little unnerved by seeing just how excited people are and how content they are with what so far has been a minor symbolic victory.
Rick, you've been active in discussing and popularizing the notion of the left's need for a new political formation, which would, in your view, hopefully lead to a new political organization. Could you elaborate on that with respect to the kind of reforms that Obama is suggesting?
Yeah, it's trying to do exactly what Max just said. It's trying to develop a group of people who get together and who begin to articulate, because it takes time and it takes work to do it, and then to popularize, to spread it, notions of what needs to be done to get us out of this mess that go beyond the strict limitations of the Republicans and the Democrats, the liberals and the conservatives. That is to raise questions about structurally changing the economy, to raise questions about reorganizing how production is organized. There's nothing sacrosanct. Human beings produced lots of goods and services before they had boards of directors, employees, employers. That's not the only way to do it. And if that's part of the problem, then changing that has to be part of the solution. And there needs to be voices organized politically to begin to make that case. It can't just be Max or me or you folks or individuals. Good as that is, important as that is, in order for these things to become effective parts of the public conversation, they have to be organized. Groups of people have to collaborate to make that happen. It's been that way before in the politics of America and elsewhere. It's that way now. If we don't have independent left political new organizations, we're going to find ourselves limited to the very discussion Max so eloquently said is unable to come up with new things and unlikely to persuade the new president to move in those directions.
I want to thank Rick and Max for, again, giving us some really good perspective on Obama, stimulus, and where we're going.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Thanks, Max. Thanks, Rick. And audience out there, stay tuned, because this won't be the last you'll hear of these ideas that we discussed today.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
In the early 1990s, Deborah LaBelle, an Ann Arbor civil rights attorney, and other lawyers brought a class action on behalf of 500 women prisoners in Michigan on claims that they were sexually assaulted by prison guards. The case has taken years to come to trial. First, there was an argument that the prisoners were not persons under the Michigan civil rights law. That took 8 years. Then there was more and more litigation. Finally, the first 18 cases went to trial in two separate trials. The trials resulted in resounding victories for the women, an extraordinary set of litigation. Today we're joined by Deb LaBelle, who headed the team of lawyers on behalf of the women. LaBelle was recently quoted saying, no one in this country, no one in a civilized society is sentenced to be raped and assaulted in prison.
Attorney Deb LaBelle, welcome to Law and Disorder.
It's a pleasure to be here.
We know that you organized and have successfully conducted two trials against the state of Michigan for sexual abuse of women prisoners. Evidently, the guards in Michigan thought that free sex with prisoners was part of their job description. You've disabused them of that notion. Really just outstanding victories for the protection of prisoners and prisoners' rights. And we understand that there's a Court of Appeals decision that came out. Tell us what was at stake and what you've won.
I think what's at stake here in the whole issue all along was actually the case started with reframing the issue of what were the rights of people in detention and what were some of the basic human rights of women in detention and their bodily integrity and their right to be free of any sexual harassment or sexual misconduct, similar to people on the outside in any kind of state facility or employment setting. And one of the big things of the case was that we started out using a law that had never been used on behalf of people in detention before, but was the State Civil Rights Act that was promulgated to primarily, I think, protect people from gender and racial abuse in employment, but had been expanded to state facilities. And so for the first time we said, you know, you have to use the laws of people who are entitled to basic rights on the outside. These apply to people behind walls as well to protect the integrity of all of us. The big fight for so many years was just that. And going up to the Court of Appeals with the state argued that people who were in detention were not persons for purposes of the Civil Rights Act. And so that was actually a crucial fight for a very long time.
It took you a while to get that principle established before you had your trial. Is that what you're saying?
It took us 8 years.
Oh, my gosh.
Wow.
When did you start this case?
In 1996.
And how far back did the assaults and rapes go
Well,
in the case? I know they probably go back forever, but...
1993.
And it took you 8 years to win the principle that you could use a law in prison, or that the women in prison were persons.
Yes.
Well, what was so extraordinary is that you sought out to defend really the most wretched of the wretched and stood up for them and prevailed. Tell us what the trials were like.
Well, you know, the first trial, and we had struggled for 12 years to get to trial. We'd gone up on appellate issues 15 times. So we finally get to trial. We finally walk in the door. And, you know, I have to say, one of the things that it was January in Michigan, last January, and I kept thinking, this whole trial is asking a jury to validate the human rights of women prisoners. And the majority of the women were still in prison. Seven of them were serving life without possibility of parole for crimes they had committed.
This is the 18 people in the first case.
This is the first 10.
The first 10. Okay. Yeah.
And so, Michigan's economy is horrific. Foreclosures all over. And the concept that whether this idea of the basic rights of people would prevail in that economy with a jury in Michigan to do what only we can do to compensate people, which is award money. And whether they would award the kind of money that would validate the humanity of the women. That was the central issue. Because, you know, many cases on prisoner rights are tried for injunctive relief and not damages. And all of us on this team, all the fantastic lawyers on this team, felt very strongly that if you're going to change a mindset about this, you have to have people recognize that what happens to people in detention hurts them deeply, damages them deeply, and you have to recognize the damages. And under our system, the way you recognize damages is you put a monetary amount on it. That's how it works. So you have to sue for damages, not just change, though we have injunctive claims as well that we've been working on all these years. But in order to do that, you have to say, you must say that these women were hurt, and hurt in such a deep way that the state has to pay money, and large sums of it. This was the case that, you know, other than, I think, the Attica cases, it's, you know, no one has awarded these kinds of money to people in prison.
What was the kind of money?
Well, the judgments range from over $6 million for one woman to, I think, $1.5 million was the lowest.
Do you think it was the egregiousness of some of the fact patterns, how these women have been treated? And could you just mention a few things so that the audience knows the extent of the abuse?
Yes. I think that part of it was some of the women had been abused over a period of 8 years by various male guards. The abuse ranged from, you know, out-and-out rapes to forced oral sex to groping pat-downs in which, you know, it sort of brings to mind Tail Hook, you know, where the male guards would stand outside the eating hall, and as women would come out, they would call out certain women, and they would do pat-downs, only it would involve pinching nipples, you know, stroking the women, grabbing them, making comments, all of this in the guise of doing a legal pat-down. And one of the extreme damages, over and above the actual rapes, the abuse, the constant sexual harassment and degrading treatment while you're in captivity. So, you know, one of the testimony was that the woman put in front of their cell door, they would put pop cans just so they could maybe have a warning when the cell door was opened and the guard came in at night. They'd have a few minutes to sort of guard themselves as to what was coming. When you get raped on the outside, many of the rapes are stranger rapes, but you can get away after from that place, or you leave that apartment, or you maybe don't see that person again. Here, you're in captivity, and the very person who has done the abuse is coming the next day, and the next day, and the next day. And so the kind of environment, the horrificness of being in a closed environment, I think was something we were able to explain to the jury. And the kind of damage when this is done at the hands of the state, there's a particular harm. You're sent to prison because you violated the law, and that's your punishment. And you're being guarded by the people who are supposed to rehabilitate you, the very state that's charged with, you know, judging your character. And to be abused by them creates a special kind of despondency, a kind of despair that there is no, there's really no hope. If these are the people who are judging us and setting the standards and they're doing this to us, it causes, you know, we talked about the kind of breakdown of any hope of justice. And I also think that, you know, many of the women, most of our clients are like most women who are in prison. They have a history of child sexual abuse. And so they came in vulnerable. Many of the crimes that they commit stem out of some abuse, some self-medication, drug use, and they come in damaged. And then for the state to, you know, grind them down to even worse a state was, I think, appalling.
There was one trial for 10, and then there was another trial for 8. And then I guess what you're saying is that today you got the results of the appeal on the 10. Is that right?
That's correct. There are 500 women, and it's a class. And what the court decided is we would try them in groups of 10. And so we've been trying. There are 8 prisons, so we're going to try 8 trials, the first 8, each prison, to show that there was this culture of abuse at each prison holding women.
What is going to happen now? You've won an appeal. I mean, it sounds to me like it's time for the state to settle. I mean, I'm not sure what to say here, other than they want to drag you out for another 5 years. Wind up paying more and more money without having a settlement, just dragging it out so they don't have to pay right away.
Right. The first verdict, one of the things I do want to mention is that one of the stunning things about the first verdict is the jury came forward at the end and they issued an apology. They stood up after they read the verdicts and they said, we want to, on behalf of the citizens of Michigan, apologize for the torture you suffered at the hands of
them. Were the women in the court at
they
the time?
Were.
Wow, that's so moving.
It was
that's
so
amazing.
Cathartic. You know, the women said they didn't even hear anything other than that because the first time they were believed. Then the state said, that's a fluke, you know, because the state has, the problem with this is, you know, the state has continually said these are liars, they're prostitutes, they're criminals, and no one will give them money. I mean, the same argument that they're not a person is being played out in the trial. And so we thought we got through on that, and they said it was a fluke. So we tried one more, and the verdicts were very similar. And so they said, we'll reverse it on appeal. The court has ordered them into settlement. They said that they would get everything reversed on appeal, and it was premature, and the court said, you will talk, because, you know, there are 482 more women to go. This is insanity. So now, in 2 weeks, the Court of Appeals issued this lovely opinion, talking about, you know, the Human Rights Watch reports that found there was a culture of abuse here, finding who was accountable, and affirming the jury and the judge on every single, I think there were 12 issues they raised on appeal.
I think the results are obviously, I mean, significant for your clients. There's sounds like there's 8 prisons in which women are held. Is there been a change in behavior? At what point, if there was a change, did it start to change?
Well, I think that you mean for the better?
Yes. If it's for the worse,
yeah,
Deb,
no,
then, you know, we're all retiring and we're going to become drifters, I think.
You know, we tried for years to do, you know, settlement agreements on injunctive relief, and it just kept feeling like we had given, you know, a wonderful duck confit recipe to Burger Chef, you know, or Burger King. I mean, they just couldn't get it right. And part of it was this total deniability still and this refusal to recognize, you know, we even tried to get them to agree to some kind of truth and reconciliation hearings, you know, with the staff who, and so we kept pushing it, and finally I just gave up and said, all right, we're going to move to have men removed from the housing units of the women's prisons in Michigan. And we fought that issue till 2005, it's 3 years now, where the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed that that was a BFOQ, men in the prisons.
What's a BFOQ?
It was a bona fide job qualification that you not be a male in the women's prison.
Wow, yeah. I understand. Right, wow. Okay. Under Title VII and under discrimination.
Yeah. So the men were removed in 2006, and they were also prohibited from doing any touching of women. And so that federal ruling, not only for Michigan, but it also the federal commission, bipartisan commission, has now recommended that males not be in housing units across the country and in the Bureau of Prisons, relying upon that. That certainly made things better. You know, you took away, there's still in Michigan the culture, and there's still assaults going on because they refuse to validate when women complain. They say, oh, now you're just jumping on the litigation bandwagon. So we still have work to do, but it's much better.
Deb, have you heard the argument used before in other jurisdictions that inmates are not humans?
Well, you know, most people do the litigation under the Federal Civil Rights Act, the 1983 claims. And so there's a long history of, quote, prisoner rights under that, in which the federal courts long ago held that the Civil Rights Act applies to people in prison, although not in its totality, to the level of free people. But I'd never heard anybody argue that they weren't persons.
Deb, what's going to happen now? Where do you go from here?
Well, we're hoping that the state sits down and has really strong settlement discussions with us. We have another trial scheduled for March.
Oh, good.
So, you know, we're going to do another 10. And so we're really hoping that, because as this is, I mean, it's not a, the jury got it right. These women were really hurt. And many of them are out and stumbling and going back into prison, self-medicating, going back in. And so we really hope the state says, listen, people were really hurt, and you have to acknowledge this, and you have to have some intervention, and they need treatment. I mean, really serious treatment. At the last trial, not only did our experts say that these women were, even 10 years after the fact, suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, but the state's psychological forensic expert switched sides in midstream and testified for us.
Oh, what a remarkable thing.
As the story unfolds, there's just one more amazing thing after the other.
It was amazing. He just said, in his deposition, right before trial, he said, you know what? They all do have it. And she said, oh, it must be from prior. The attorney general said, you mean from prior abuse? And this is a quote. He said, no, I mean from the Abu Ghraib-like conditions in Michigan.
That's fabulous. Wow. Deb, I have a couple more questions. One is the effects of this case on women's prisons throughout the country. I mean, Michigan, you know, may have had a very bad situation, but I'm sure it's not unique for women in prison and having male guards, et cetera. Can you just talk about that for a moment? Are male guards still guarding women in many prisons? Is this kind of abuse going on?
Well, it is going on, although I think that Michigan stopping the cross-gender pat-downs, we got some decisions on that, which was used in California to stop it out there. I think that taking males out of the prison and showing you can do that effectively in the housing units, and you know, I have to say, I actually think it's a benefit to the male staff as well, that many of the good ones were terribly conflicted about, you know, having to touch and see women nude and, you know, maintain that kind of moral integrity that they grew up with and social norms. So I think that showing that you can do that without causing a problem is starting to float in other states. And also these issues are, you know, that juries will hear these issues. I'm talking to attorneys in many states in which they have gotten their departments to readily talk about resolving things because of their fear of what a jury might do now.
And it's sort of a different era, so I just want to just get your sense of it. Obviously, there's a huge amount of sexual abuse in men's prisons as well. More probably inmate on inmate than guard on inmate, although I actually don't know. Has there been anything to address that around the country at all?
Right. The commission, and when you say it is it is a lot on a prisoner on prisoner, but most of it goes on with the facilitation of staff. You know, that kind of abuse doesn't happen in a closed, monitored setting without some state involvement.
Right, I understand that, right. Actually. I think that's
so
right.
So the Federal Commission on Prison Rape Elimination Act Commission addresses strongly those issues, and they put out standards. They have a sunset commission that ends in June, and they put out standards just a couple months ago that is really strongly trying to address those issues and really just address the whole issue of how destructive it is to us socially to abuse people who, you know, go into prison for mostly a few years and then come back into society, and how, you know, it's the old Foucault, the old Dostoevsky, about how it does measure us as a society if we fail to honor the humanity of people in detention.
Well, Deb LaBelle, you're just an outstanding attorney. We all take our hats off to you. Congratulations on this terrific victory in Michigan with its rippling effects from the Midwest on both coasts. It's just wonderful talking to you, and you know, continue your good work.
If your summation was anything like this radio show, I can see why you won.
Oh, it's anyway. A pleasure to talk to you guys. You're all my heroes.
Anyway, Deb.
Thanks for being on Law and Disorder.
Congratulations.
Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.